This is tape number 4 from the Book of Grace, Ram Dass's program at the Upland Hills Ecological Awareness Center, and it took place on February 15th and 16th, 1997.
Now, ultimately, the economics of our technology has said, well, we got to rethink this, along with the morality of it. And what came along, which was economically much more feasible and more realistic, was the hospice, where you went when you knew that you were probably going to die, and therefore you would have a support system, but you wouldn't have this kind of incredible effort to deny the forces that were acting upon you, as if some terrible error was being made. And doctors, the medical community, treated death as a failure. And it's a terrible thing to be in a business in which you always fail. And you always do, because everybody dies. Have you noticed that? It's a tough business. And that's why there's such a high degree of breakdown and alcoholism and burnout and in all these kinds of professions, these caring professions. Because they're pitting themselves against nature, if you will. Instead of listening and being a support to keep alive, but allow for whatever is in the way of things. So in Cambridge, a group of us got together to create a hospice. Hospice movement came over from England, and it was a really good need for this society. It was a place where people could come and have a good psychological support system. Originally, hospice had a spiritual underpinning to it. The predicament was for hospice later to get Medicare and Medicaid funds. In the way our government works, it had to play down the spiritual aspects of it. So what I generally find in working in the hospice movement is that the people, the individuals in the hospice movement, are spiritually sort of secret spiritual warriors in a system that is basically a humanist bureaucracy. That may be too fierce, but I think you can all hear what the issue is. So we decided to do this on our own way. And I know that there are a lot of people, I know doctors and nurses around the country that say to me, is there any place I can go where I can really support people and be in a spiritual environment to be with people as they're dying? And there are dying people that say, hey, I'm dying of AIDS, or I'm dying of cancer, or I'm dying of this or that. Could I go somewhere where people wouldn't treat me as if I'm an uninhabited body? So I thought, we'll put them together. We'll call it a monastery or an ashram. Everybody's there to awaken spiritually. Some of them are dying, and some of them are helping some of them die. Sounds reasonable. So we got this beautiful plan going in Cambridge. There were engineers, there were people from Harvard, there were nurses, there were heads of other hospices. It was quite a creative group, and we were going to have a beautiful thing. And the interior decorators of Boston came along and said, we're each going to donate a room so you can have one room. You can die in Elizabethan times. You could die in modern. You could die in whatever way you wanted to die. And that was going to be great. Now, in my model, the staff, this was a big ashram. Everybody lived there. And I only really wanted to work with everybody's dying. I mean, billions of people are dying. That's the way of the world. I figured this would be just for people who wanted to work on their consciousness through their dying process. So then we caught the attention of the state of Massachusetts. And the state of Massachusetts says, well, we are very impressed with what you're doing. Allow us to give you $1 million. Which we took. And with that came the end of the experiment. Because the first thing they said was, well, you can't select your patients. You've got to tell them the first come, the first serve. That's only fair. Well, I thought to myself, the average length of life in the hospice is 40 days, so they're coming and going anyway. As long as the staff are working on their consciousness, well, I'll make that compromise. Oh, you can't have the staff living in the facility. That's out of the question. They can only work 8-hour days or 10-hour days. And you've got to pick the staff in terms of their seniority. You can't pick in terms of... So pretty soon they had washed out the entire experiment. And that hospice has come to be, and it's a very fine hospice, and it serves people, and it helps people, but it is not a place for conscious awakening. That's the kind of experiment. I just wanted to go into some depth to share that with you for a moment. What I was finding out through my practices, through my teaching, through all of these different service projects that I was involved in, of which these were two I was mentioning, first of all, I was finding out that karma yoga, or the yoga of service, is a very beautiful yoga. The yoga meaning coming to one, or waking up, or coming into spirit, or remembering God, or whatever. That service is an incredible vehicle through which to do it. And it shows you all of your warts along the way. It's great. I took care of Dad for the last 8 or 10 years before he died. And my first feeling when I was told that I was the one that should take care of Dad was, well, I guess I'll have to do it. And people said to me, aren't you good to be taking care of your father? And I said, well, somebody has to do it. And I was being righteous because I was giving up my individual freedom a little bit, not much, but a little bit, to do this act for my father. That's the world I was living in that saw it that way. As that dance went on, which went on for 8 or 10 years, I mean, I didn't take care of him full time. I had an apartment in his house, and I made sure he was taken care of and did days off and things like that when I was in town. Took care of all the finances and stuff. As the time went on, the whole dance changed. And we started to, pretty soon I was taking care of him just in the same way as you do, you'd cook, take care of yourself. It was just we were involved in a process, a dance together, and who was taking care of whom ceased to be the important thing at all. There was just a relationship, there was a process going on. And when he died, I came away feeling that I had been given such an incredible gift to be allowed, A, to complete that relationship with my father, and to grow in the way in which I got out of being the doer, the kind giver, the individual, and opened myself to being part of a system that is a family. That's the wonderful story about the old Japanese monk, I mean the old farmer who's sitting on the porch, rocking, and his married son is tilling the field. And the son looks at the father and he thinks, he's old now, you know, and he's another mouth to feed. Maybe it's time. So the son goes and he builds a nice, beautiful teak wooden box, puts it in the wheelbarrow, drives it up to the porch, and he says, Father, get in. Father gets in, put the top on the box. He's wheeling it towards the cliff. There's a knock from inside the box. The father says, Son, I know what you're about to do, and it's perfectly okay. I understand why you're doing it. But may I make a suggestion? Could I suggest that you save the box because your children will need it later? See, that's the sense of the whole business of the continuity. And by my taking care of Dad, I found my way back into a continuity that I had lost in my zeal to be independent. And to me, that is a key awakening that came to me in those years, was the recognition that freedom, inner freedom, did not mean the denial of membership in systems. That I was part of community in 9 different ways. I was part of eco-community, of nation community, of religious community, of family community, of cosmic community. And there was a way of honoring my membership in all those communities that had to do with the freedom to delight in the incarnation, in being incarnated. The honoring of the incarnation rather than the repudiating of it. And I saw that what had happened in the 60s was in the awakening of this inner feeling and the zeal to honor one's inner truth, we had thrown away the baby with the bath. We had thrown away our identity with community in order to say, what do I need? What do I want? What do I need? And many people who had grown up in a system where they were part of family and church and all that were appalled to see people being so selfish. But that was a reaction against the repression that kept people as part of communities before. There is another way of being part of a community, which is an awakening to the freedom to be in a celebratory way honoring your participation in community. That's the next level of the game. That's when the balance reasserts itself, the balance between individual and membership in systems, and learning how to be all of those and not being trapped in any of it. Not being trapped in any of it. For those of you that have heard me speak in the past 10 years, you undoubtedly have heard this story. I read it again because it is the best teaching story that I have found to convey what I am trying to share about the way in which one brings the inner into the outer world. This is a story that was told to us. It's printed in the book that I did with Paul Gorman called How Can I Help? And it's a story that was told to us by Terry Dobson, who was an Aikido master who had trained for many years in Japan and was living in Vermont and has died the past years. And I read this in memoriam. This is his story. The train clanked and rattled through the suburbs of Tokyo on a drowsy spring afternoon. Our car was comparatively empty. A few housewives with their kids in tow. Some old folks going shopping. I gazed absently at the drab houses and dusty hedgerows. At one station, the doors opened and suddenly the afternoon quiet was shattered by a man bellowing violent, incomprehensible curses. The man staggered into our car. He wore laborer's clothing and he was big, drunk, and dirty. Screaming, he swung at a woman holding a baby. The blow sent her spinning into the laps of an elderly couple. It was a miracle that the baby was unharmed. Terrified, the couple jumped up and scrambled towards the other end of the car. The laborer aimed a kick at the retreating back of the old woman, but missed as she scuttled to safety. This so enraged the drunk that he grabbed the metal pole in the center of the car and tried to wrench it out of its stanchion. I could see that one of his hands was cut and bleeding. The train lurched ahead, the passengers frozen with fear. I stood up. I was young then, some 20 years ago, and in pretty good shape. I had been putting in a solid 8 hours of Aikido training nearly every day for the past 3 years. I liked to throw and grapple. I thought I was tough. The trouble was, my martial skill was untested in actual combat. As students of Aikido, we were not allowed to fight. Aikido, my teacher said again and again, is the art of reconciliation. Whoever has the mind to fight has broken his connection with the universe. If you try to dominate people, you're already defeated. We study how to resolve conflict, not how to start it. I listened to his words. I tried so hard. I even went so far as to cross the street to avoid the chimpira, the pinball punks who lounged around the train stations. My forbearance exalted me. I felt both tough and holy. In my heart, however, I wanted an absolutely legitimate opportunity whereby I might save the innocent by destroying the guilty. This is it, I said to myself as I got to my feet. People are in danger. If I don't do something fast, somebody will probably get hurt. Seeing me stand up, the drunk recognized a chance to focus his rage. Aha! He roared. A foreigner! You need a lesson in Japanese manners. I held on lightly to the commuter strap overhead and gave him a slow look of disgust and dismissal. I planned to take this turkey apart, but he had to make the first move. I wanted him mad, so I pursed my lips and blew him an insolent kiss. All right, he hollered. You're gonna get a lesson. He gathered himself for a rush at me. A fraction of a second before he could move, someone shouted, "Hey!" It was ear-splitting. I remember the strangely joyous, lilting quality of it, as though you and a friend had been searching diligently for something and he had suddenly stumbled upon it. Hey! I wheeled to my left, the drunk spun to his right. We both stared down at a little old Japanese man. He must have been well into his 70s, this tiny gentleman sitting there immaculate in his kimono. He took no notice of me, but he beamed delightedly at the laborer as though he had a most important, most welcome secret to share. Come here, the old man said in easy vernacular, beckoning to the drunk. Come here and talk with me. He waved his hand lightly. The big man followed as if on a string. He planted his feet belligerently in front of the old gentleman and roared above the clacking wheels, "Why the hell should I talk to you?" The drunk now had his back to me. If his elbow moved so much as a millimeter, I'd drop him in his socks. The old man continued to beam at the laborer. "What you been drinking?" he asked, his eyes sparkling with interest. "I've been drinking sake," the laborer bellowed back, "and it's none of your business." Flecks of spittle spattered the old man. "Oh, that's wonderful," the old man said, "absolutely wonderful. You know, I love sake, too. Every night, me and my wife, she's 76, you know, we warm up a little bottle of sake, and we take it out into the garden, and we sit on an old wooden bench. We watch the sun go down, and we look to see how our persimmon tree is doing. You know, my great-grandfather planted that tree, and we worry about whether it will recover after those ice storms we had last winter. But you know our tree has done better than I expected, especially when you consider the poor quality of the soil. It's gratifying to watch when we take our sake and we go out to enjoy the evening, even when it rains." He looked up at the laborer, his eyes twinkling. As he struggled to follow the old man's conversation, the drunk's face began to soften. His fist slowly unclenched. "Yeah," he said, "I love persimmons too." His voice trailed off. "Yes," said the old man, smiling, "and I'm sure you have a wonderful wife."
"No," replied the laborer, "my wife died."
Very gently, swaying with the motion of the train, the big man began to sob. "I don't got no wife. I don't got no home. I don't got no job. I'm so ashamed of myself." Tears rolled down his cheeks. A spasm of despair rippled through his body. There I was, standing in my well-scrubbed youthful innocence, my make this world safe for democracy righteousness. I suddenly felt dirtier than he was. The train arrived at my stop. The doors opened. I heard the old man cluck sympathetically. "My, my," he said, "that is a difficult predicament indeed. Sit down here and tell me about it." I turned my head for one last look. The laborer was sprawled on the seat, his head in the old man's lap. The old man was softly stroking the filthy, matted hair. As the train pulled away, I sat down on a bench. What I had wanted to do with muscle had been accomplished with kind words. I had just seen Aikido tried in combat, and the essence of it was love. Can you see the way in which we live in the subway car, where there is violence, where there is uncertainty, there's fear? And it's so easy to get caught in the reactive mode to that, as Terry did, stand up to make it right for everybody. Where do you suppose the old Japanese man's consciousness was, that in the midst of that situation, which he was part of too, he yelled, "Hey!" joyously. Where would that come from? Do you think he thought to himself, "This is a tough situation, I better yell hey joyously"? I mean, do you think it was mediated through his intellect? Or do you think he was just in tune with the situation in a way that felt in his being the root nature of the suffering, and was responding in a way that was in the way of things, that shifted all of the energies of the situation? He didn't seem agitated, didn't seem angry. The question is, for us in the world, when we see injustice and we see environmental degradation, can we act in response to that in a way that does not exacerbate the root causes of the problem? And that story so much shows me the possibility that that can be done and how it works. What that man lived his life to be was somebody who was resting in his being deeply enough so that he was not caught in the reactive mode of the situations he found himself in. And yet, of course, he was present in them, fully present in them. I'd ask you if you find yourself in that same situation. And if not, why not? If it is possible for a human being to, at the same time, be living life with all of its storm and trial and joy and sadness and comings and goings and good and evil, and at the same time cultivate a place of presence or awareness or centeredness that doesn't flicker as the world situation changes. There's a statement in the spiritual literature that says, for that part of you inside that doesn't flicker, it says, "One to me is pleasure and pain." It's an interesting one. Ah, pleasure. Ah, pain. One to me is loss and gain. Oh, there it goes. Here it comes. One to me is fame and shame. When you really get in the advanced course, one to me is life and death. See, to know that the awakening leads you to understand that there is a place in you that is behind the duality, behind the polarities of the world. It's behind dualism. It's not me and you. It's not even us. It's I. And to learn how to rest in that, to learn how to rest in that which is often called living spirit. That's the place from which you can sit in the world of uncertainty and fear and illness and aging and death and dying and loss and confusion and anger and upset and say, hey, wow, look at this. My challenge to you, as fellow pilgrims on the journey, is to cultivate a stability in living on two planes of consciousness simultaneously. As Christ said, in the world, but not of the world. To be fully, passionately involved in life and also be totally equanimous and centered. And this is not an either-or, it's a both-and. At first it's either-or, and then if you cultivate it, it becomes both-and. People say to me, what two planes should I live on? And I say, I don't give a damn, any two planes will do. Just become aware that there is more than one plane of reality. Your dreams are a plane of reality. How many of you are able to stay, I'm not asking, I'm just, how many of you are able to stay conscious when you're dreaming? No, you're dreaming. You're dreaming, and yet you know you're dreaming. Well, this is another one. You are dreaming now. Do you know you're dreaming? Is there a part of you that isn't in this dream? Or are you all, are all of us here in this beautiful room? Is that the only reality we're meeting on? Or can we share the awareness that is aware of our predicament?
Please fast forward to the end, and then flip the tape to begin side B.